Everybody has their cause today. And I'm not against causes. I think that's a good thing. But I think too many people, their cause has become their religion. Whatever it may be. That is their God, if you want to call it that. And there's not any of these, well, except the two bottom ones, that I'm against. Okay? I understand that we need to care about animals. That Proverbs teaches that. The wise man cares for his animals. Joshua and I were going down the road the other day, Wednesday, I think it was, anyway, and a little squirrel, and you know how squirrels do, go up across the street, and 9 times out of 10, maybe even more than that, you know they're going to get run over, but they don't. But on this particular time, the squirrel not only went across, but then he did a little dance under the car. And you know how that one ended. And it wasn't pretty. There is a need for that. God has put that in us. The planet, the women's issues, the men's issues, politics of every kind. All these things, people live and die for these things. Now the bottom two are football on this side and soccer on this side. And particularly if you're familiar with seeing soccer games in Europe. I mean, this is a live or die thing. And if we lose, it goes up in flames. When we talk about these things, and why did I bring them up in this, a sermon? Because I think there's something there. Someone has said, David something Foster said in a commencement speech, you are what you eat, you're what you worship will eat you up, will consume you. And I think the way the Bible says it that John just read for us, you will become like what you worship. And so that brings us to, I think, a very important question. What do you worship? Well, of course I worship God. That's why I'm here. And that's why all these other, however many people there are in churches, to worship God. But I think too often, what we worship is not God. We give God something. We give God our partial worship, but there's something that is what we know all about. And I think about football, sports fanatics in general. They can tell you the stats of every quarterback. They can tell you who are the Heisman Trophy nominees this year. They can tell you everything. They can tell you where each team stands in the standing. But then maybe that's not your thing. Maybe it's the soap opera. Maybe it's politics. Maybe, and again, it's all about this thing. That's what you watch. And you know, we're really blessed. You can have two or three TVs now in your room, and you can be watching sports or whatever on every channel. But what do you worship? And I want us to just think about that and talk about and look at this from, I think, a biblical perspective. And certainly one of the things that a lot of people put a lot of emphasis on now is their money, is on their possessions, is on what their bank account looks like. Our son, Pax, you know, it's a builder, and he's remodeling a house in Franklin, Tennessee. $8 million. 200 doors. 29 bedrooms. 4 floors. Every luxury you can think of, and some you have not thought of. It has a one-lane bowling alley inside. It has an indoor pool, not to mention the outdoor pool. And I mean, the list goes on and on and on and on. And why? For two people? You really wonder. But what it seems, and he deals with them a lot, what it seems like is this is one of those that if my neighbor has a $7 million house, I have to have an $8 million house. But you and I both know what's going to happen to that house at some point. It's going to decay. It's going to be gone. And so in Matthew chapter 6, at verse 19, Jesus warns us about where we should put our treasure. He says, "Do not lay up for yourself treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, what you're worshiping is where your heart is also." How do I know what I'm worshiping? It's what is most important to me. Now he goes on to say in verse 22, "The lamp of the body is the eye. If therefore your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, your whole body will be full of darkness. If therefore the light that is in you is darkness, how great is that darkness?" Now just think of a room, and you have a light. And you have a light that's very bright. You can see everything in the room. But if you put a cover on that light, or the power goes out, and it gets dark, how dark is it? It's very dark. And his point is, what is it that channels your eye? What is it you're always seeing? What is it that's important to you? If it's a good thing, perfect. If it's a bad thing, it's going to be like you were in a room with all the doors closed, there's no windows, and there's no light. Because that's what your life is going to be like. And he goes on to say, "No one can serve two masters. For either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon," or riches. Mammon is an Aramaic word that means riches. So what is it that you worship? Is it all about getting ahead? Those things will perish. In Matthew 19, and it seems like we've talked about this guy a lot recently, the rich young ruler, a one who came to Jesus sincerely asking, "What good thing do I have to do to inherit eternal life? I want to know." And Jesus tells him, "Keep the commandments." "Well, which one?" He tells him. And he says, "I've done those since I was young. What else do I lack?" And he feels, you know, it seems like he feels like there's got to be more to this than just that. What else? And in verse 21, Jesus said to him, "If you want to be perfect, complete, go, sell what you have and give it to the poor, and you will have treasure in heaven, and come follow me." But when the young man heard that saying, he went away sorrowful, for he had great possessions. Now, is Jesus saying we all have to give everything to the poor? No. He's saying to this young man whose possessions possessed him, if you want to be complete, go sell all that, get rid of it, and come follow me. And he couldn't do it because his possessions possessed him. In 1 Timothy chapter 6, it's interesting, in this last chapter of 1 Timothy, there are two different admonitions to the rich. Chapter 6, verse 6, also beginning, Now, godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. But those who desire to be rich fall into temptations and a snare, and into many foolish and harmful lusts, which draw men into destruction and perdition. You think about those who are going to be rich at any cost. Is morality, is righteousness, is that their main thrust? Or is it, how can I make a dollar? And when all it's about is how I can make a dollar, what's right, what's wrong, that either gets blurry or just gets forgotten altogether. And you see the end of it. Now, jumping down, if you will, with me to verse 17. It says, command those who are rich in this present world not to be haughty, nor to trust in uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us richly all things to enjoy. He talks about the transitory, uncertain riches. And truly, we have seen that. I think about the Great Depression. The people that had it made, and all of a sudden, it was all gone. Now, that was on a grand scale. But it can happen to you on an individual scale, to me. And he says, but trust not in these uncertain riches, but in the living God who gives us all richly all things to enjoy. Let them, those who have the money, let them do good that they be rich in good works, ready to give, willing to share, storing up for themselves a good foundation for the time to come, that they may lay hold on that which is life indeed. If you're worshiping money, possessions, chasing all the things that so many of in our culture are chasing, just remember, those things are all going to perish. They're not lasting. In 2 Peter chapter 3 and verse 10, after reminding us of the readers there, in verse 10, there will come a judgment day. The day of the Lord will come as a thief in the night, in which the heavens will pass away with a great noise, and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Both the earth and the works that are in it will be burned up. Now, since these things will all be dissolved, what manner of persons ought you to be in holy conduct and godliness, looking for and hastening, in looking forward to, hoping for, the coming of the day of God, because of which the heavens will be dissolving on fire and the elements will melt with fervent heat. Nevertheless, we, according to His promise, look for a new heaven and a new earth in which righteousness dwells. These things will all be destroyed. We can't take them with us, and even if we could, they're going to be destroyed. So when we ask, think about that. And another thing, and I think this is, at least this is the one you see glorified all the time, is every kind of sexual immorality, fornication, whatever you want, all of it. And it's there, and this is something that is good. This is portrayed as good. This is something that's what it's all about. But it is also not what it's all about. Going back to Hosea, to chapter 9, and there at verse 8, the watchman, it says, of Ephraim is with my God. But the prophet, who's supposed to be seeking for God, is a fowler snare in all his ways. He's just there trying to catch people. Enmity in the house of his God. There's enmity. He's an enemy of God. They are deeply corrupted, as in the days of Gibeah. He will remember their iniquity. He will punish their sin. And I want you to think about Gibeah. This may or may not be something you've ever read. It's ugly. And I mean, that's all we can say about it. It's ugly. In Judges chapter 19, and obviously we don't have time to to read all of this. But a man is traveling. He gets to the city of Gibeah, one of the cities of the tribe of Benjamin, of God's people. He gets there with his concubine, a servant, and a donkey that has their stuff on it. And he comes to the, sits in the plaza where normally someone would have said, "Are you here? Do you have somewhere to stay?" "No." "Oh, well, come stay at my house. It may not be much, but it's there." As I say in Spanish, "Mi humilde casa," my humble house. But no one does, which is surprising, which is not right. Finally, an older man from another tribe comes in and sees them, and he tells them, "Come to my house and stay with me." In verse 22, it says, "As they were enjoying themselves, eating and drinking, suddenly certain men of the city, perverted men, surrounded the house and beat on the door. They spoke to the master of the house, the old man, saying, 'Bring out the man who came to your house that we may know him carnally and we may have sex with him.' But the man, the master of the house, went out to them and said to them, 'No, my brethren, I beg you, do not act so wickedly. Seeing this man has come into my house, do not commit this outrage. Look, here's my virgin daughter and the man's concubine. Let me bring them out now, humble them, do with them as you please. But to this man, do not do such a thing, a vile thing.' They didn't listen. The man took his concubine and brought her out to them. They abused her. They knew her all night. Until morning, when the day began to break, they let her go. She crawled up to the doorstep and died." Now, just think about that. What is there in this picture that's good? And there's not a blessed thing. There's nothing. And that's what God is reminding them of. Now, it gets even worse, because when the tribe, the other tribes of Israel, become aware of it, they go to Benjamin, they send messengers, and they say, "Those men in Gibeah, they have to be punished. The punishment is death." "Nope. Nope. We're going to defend them. If you want to kill them, you're going to have to kill us first." And I mean, it gets worse. But the point that God is making here in Hosea: remember those days. They are deeply corrupted. That's where Israel was again. And you talk about the bottom of the barrel. That's where they're at. In chapter 10, excuse me, let's continue reading verse 10 first. "I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your fathers as the first fruit of the fig tree in its first season." Oh, this is promise of, oh, this is great, this is good things. "But they went to Baal Peor and separated themselves to that shame." We'll talk about Baal, the Baal of Peor, in a minute. "They became an abomination like the thing they loved." This is what they loved. This is what they went after. In chapter 10, verse 9, "O Israel, you have sinned from the days of Gibeah. There they stood, the battle in Gibeah against the children of iniquity did not overtake them." And again, just to briefly go over Baal, the Baal of Peor. Baal was one of the gods of the Canaanites. And this particular Baal was in a city, named Peor. And so that's why it's Baal Peor. But in chapter 25, beginning at verse 1, it says, "Now Israel remained in Acacia Grove, and the people began to commit harlotry with the women of Moab. They, the women, invited the people to sacrifices of their gods, and the people ate and bowed down to their gods." They worshipped their gods. So Israel was joined. And it isn't that they looked at him, they saw him. They were joined. They became a part of it, to Baal of Peor. And the anger of the Lord was aroused against Israel. Then the Lord said to Moses, "Take all the leaders of the people and get them to hang the offenders before the Lord out in the sun, that the fierce anger of the Lord may turn away from Israel." So Moses said to the judges of Israel, every one of you kill his men, those under your control, who are joined to Baal of Peor. And indeed, one of the children of Israel came and presented to his brethren a Midianite woman in the sight of Moses, in the sight of all the congregation of the children of Israel, who were weeping at the door of the tabernacle of meeting. Now, he happens to be the son of one of the leaders. She's similar rank. But not only did they go to worship the idol of Baal over there in private, but this one brings a woman into his tent, and everybody knows what they're going for. Just think about that. That's what God reminded them of. And unfortunately, these things would be tame, like they were on these particular situations today. Life is not all about sex, whatever it is. God gave us sexual relations, sexual desires to enjoy, but that's not what it's all about. And it's interesting, in the book of Joshua, in chapter 22, this is at least 40 years after the event that they're going to talk about took place, the Baal of Peor situation. In Joshua chapter 22, there at verse 16 and 18 through 18, and I'll get there in a minute. There's a problem in Israel, and notice what the high priest has to say in verse 16. Thus says the whole congregation of the Lord. He's talking for them. What treachery is this that you have committed against the God of Israel to turn away this God this day from following the Lord, that you have built for yourselves an altar that you might rebel this day against the Lord? Is the iniquity of Peor, what happened at Peor and the sin there, not enough for us, from which we are not cleansed till this day? 40 years ago. Was this a serious matter? Very serious. It's still very much on their minds. And it's sad to say, but there's a lot of people that this is what they worship. This is what it's all about. Oh, they work or not. They study, whatever it is, but this is what it's really all about. And I want us to think about what is the end of all these things. And we're going back to the New Testament again. Often it can be physical death. But more importantly, it's going to be spiritual death. And look with me, if you will, in Galatians chapter 5. Galatians 5, beginning there at verse 19. Now the works of the flesh are evident, which are idolatry, fornication, uncleanness, lewdness, idolatry, sorcery, hatred, contentions, jealousies, outbursts of wrath, selfish ambitions, dissensions, heresies, envy, murders, drunkenness, revelries, and the like, of which I tell you beforehand, just as I also told you in time past, that those who practice such things will not inherit the kingdom of God. They will not be in heaven. Period. This is not a maybe. This is a period. They will not. In Romans chapter 6, Romans 6, just a couple of books back, chapter 6, verse 20. Paul says, for when you were slaves of sin, all the things we just talked about, we just read, you were free in regard to righteousness. What fruit did you have then in the things of which you are now ashamed? For the end of those things is death. What did it bring forth? What did it produce? And on the other hand, just continue reading in that same passage in Romans chapter 6. Worshiping God produces life. Chapter 6, verse 17. But God be thanked that though you were slaves of sin, yet you obeyed from the heart that form of doctrine to which you were delivered. And having been set free from sin, you became slaves of righteousness. I speak in human terms because of the weakness of your flesh. For just as you presented your members as slaves of uncleanness and of lawlessness, leading to more lawlessness, so now present your members as slaves of righteousness for holiness. And this chapter ends with verse 23. The wages of sin is death, but the gift of God is life eternal. What do you worship? If you worship God, truly worship God, there are benefits. There is life. Not only a better life here, but life eternal. And going back now to Galatians chapter 5, continuing the thought. We quit it. Verse 21, now pick up at verse 22. The fruit of the Spirit is love, joy, peace, long-suffering, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, self-control. Against such there is no law. Nobody gets upset with these things unless they're envious because they don't have them. But notice that it said it's called the fruit of the Spirit. When you plant, and you know, if you've got a garden, you know someone who does, if the fruit hadn't come in yet, it's going to pretty quickly, right? But that was something that you had to wait for. You read the packages of the seeds and they tell you, you know, maturity, that means bringing fruit, 30 days, 45 days, 60 days. When we look at this list of characteristics, love, joy, peace, long-suffering, gentleness, faithfulness, self-control, it can be pretty daunting. But this is like fruit. It's cultivated. It's over time. You begin and you grow. And that's the process that we're in, that I'm in, that you're in, is continuing to grow forward. And he goes on to say, and those who are Christ have crucified the flesh with its passions and its desires. And that is our goal every day. In another place in the same book, Paul says, I have been crucified with Christ. And I think this makes the point, doesn't it? I'm right up there with him. And how do we do that? I don't live for myself. I live for Christ who lives in me. And so as we close, I want you to think about, each of us needs to think about daily, who is it